You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I remember walking round the court square sidewalks, looking in windows for things I couldn't want. There's Johnson's Hardware and Morgan's Jewelry and the old Lee King's Apothecary. They were the little man. The little man.
Joining us now, just in the nick of time, Michael Musselman.
I go back now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, MC Extraordinaire. How'd it go?
Oh, dude, that was probably one of the best nights. I'll remember that night for the rest of my life.
I heard about it.
How'd you hear about it?
Will Cosentini called me. I sent him a happy birthday text message, and he said, hey.
I got a FaceTime thing from Chuck Ziegenfuss and Musselman.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he said. I said,
he was laughing his ass off, man. We're calling from the dinner table, me and Chuck, and we're like, eh. And he's sitting there, you know, his laugh, he's got that gaping, ha, ha, ha.
Exactly. Now, but he's not related to Brian. That's odd, right?
No, it's a completely different.
Oh, is it? Is it? No, I heard it. I was like, what?
His last name is Ziegenfuss.
Fuss.
Like bus. And I kept calling him Foos, like, right. Art guy.
Yeah.
Like, dude, it's going to be a while. But he was funny, man. He said it exactly perfect. He is Will's better half, but in male form. Dude, you can imagine that.
No.
He is.
Yeah.
Funny, sarcastic, dry. I mean, just like the humor that sticks to you, and then if you don't get it right away, it's like, and then all of a sudden, oh, ha, 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 he was making fun of me. Yeah, funny guy, man. Great guy. His wife and his daughter were there. Good dude, man.
And former Marine?
No, unfortunately, Army.
Oh.
So he's not a great guy. He's just a good guy.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. The guy that I had the honor of introducing as the guest speaker overall.
Is that the picture I saw?
Yeah. 99-year-old Lieutenant Fisk Hanley II. Wow.
Tell us about it.
Oh, so I just got a message saying, what? Yeah, he said, quote, not make my quote, this Chuck now, Chuck Ziegenfuss, said, I am the exact copy of Carey, but in male form. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah, you better be careful treading at that end of the pool, okay? Because
that end of the pool's got things that'll hurt you.
Yeah, they look like jacuzzi jets. Those things are blow torches, arc welding blow torches.
You're going to be in some trouble. But that's what he said. And I was like, okay.
Very careful when you're
going. But he's a funny guy. Like I said, he was a good, it was good to meet him, and I'm sure I'll see him some more of him because I was told that he's a good guy, and so yes, he's a good guy. And I can confirm that from our friends in Missouri.
Now, where's he from? Is he
here in Texas.
In the Granbury area?
No, Decatur. Not too far.
Well, how does Will know him then if he's an Army dude?
Have you seen these messages?
No.
You're not.
No.
I just got another message from, and it says, Jesus, take the wheel. Here it comes.
So how does he know Will if he's an Army dude?
He knows Carey. He met Carey, I think, first, he said. So they met through, he got wounded. He's in the hospital. He kind of helped along this Valor IT where they're taking laptops and putting the Dragon software to help guys that couldn't use their hands.
Got it.
Carey, you know, is involved a lot with helping veterans and wounded guys.
Right.
And that's where the paths crossed. And then there's a long story of, like, how they got to be friends.
So Will meets him.
Because I'll tell you, if his humor was the way it was when they first met. Oh man, that would have been I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, because that would have been a lot of, you know, as you know, yeah, you gotta, yeah.
Yeah.
But, okay, so let's go back to Fisk, because that's the guy that I really want to
talk about. Okay, Fisk, all right, we're talking about
Fisk. So Fisk Hanley, let me tell you a real quick narrative of his bio. Fisk Hanley, 99 years old, he was a B-29 flight engineer in 1945, okay?
Right. Wait, B-17 or B-24?
I'm sorry,
B-29,
the biggest plane we had at the time.
The big silver one, chrome-looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So, in March of 1945, he gets assigned to the 304th Bomber Group, which is flying, or the 504th Bomber Group, flying out of Tinian.
Oh, that's the United. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
So, you know, and here's another, he's fine then, because he's like, did you know, Mike, that Tinian in 1945 was the world's largest and busiest airport? I said, I did not know that. So I looked it up, and sure enough, he's right. It was the largest airport in the world in 1945 because of all the B-29s that were taken off. It was just like round the clock, boom, 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 boom. Okay. Anyway, second lieutenant, I mean, check this out, man. So the bomber group, their crew consists of the plane captain, the guy who's in charge of the plane.
Right.
Newly minted second lieutenant John A. Brown.
Okay.
Then second lieutenant co-pilot, second lieutenant Albert Andrews. Then you had Baxter Love, bombardier, and Harlan Fintel, navigator, Fisk Hanley, flight engineer. And Richard Hall, tail gunner. I mean, they're all second lieutenants, the officers. And all the other guys are just like tech sergeants. They're all brand new. You know, because this is like they're pumping guys out. Boom, 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 boom.
Right.
So Fisk tells a story. They get there. They fly these training missions. And this is like the first time B-29s are being used.
Okay.
In early March or early 1945. So no one really knows anything about them. They're flying at high altitude, and they go to bomb Iwo Jima because, you know, target practice, but they knew it was going to be invaded again soon, right, one of these days. Mm-hmm. So they would go up there and use Iwo Jima as target practice. And so they go up there, and they drop the bombs, and that's when they figured out that jet stream. They didn't know it existed until then, bombardiers. So the calculations, I mean, it screwed everything up because they didn't calculate. B-29s were bombing at 35,000 feet. You know, way up there.
Whoa.
B-17s, on the other hand, were bombing at, you know, 20,000 feet, you know, max ceiling.
Right.
You know, 15,000 feet, actually, most of the time. But they're way up there, 35,000 feet, bombing Tokyo.
35. Could any aircraft get up there? Could Japanese aircraft get up there?
Yeah, the Japanese had a couple of piston or radial engines that were meant to get way up there and attack them.
Wow.
But it wasn't the Japanese planes that really, as he says, it was the flak.
Right.
You know, that cost the B-29s there. But so he goes on these practice missions. They go out on their first mission, which is the firebombing of Tokyo.
The first mission?
His first mission was the firebombing of Tokyo, the first firebombing. And they said that the B-29s are set, Mike, he's like, Mike, there's so many B-29s in there. And we're flying at night, and the Pavlo guys are going forward, and they're starting the fires to mark our bomb runs, right?
Right, right.
And so, but he goes, by the time I got up there, he goes, Tokyo, you could feel the heat, you know, at that radiating at the altitudes that they were at. And like he even said, I mean, he said it to the group. He said, you know, the crazy thing about it is everybody makes such a big deal about the nuclear bombs in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. He goes, in that night, we killed more Japanese than both of the nuclear bombs combined.
Right. Right. Most people have no clue. And then you, And you and I have talked about this, though, but
yeah.
You talk about that, and then the firebombing of Dresden, both dwarf, both nuclear explosions.
Oh, yeah. But he goes, you know, Tokyo, they firebombed it over, you know, a 24-hour period.
Right.
And then, I mean, just, and then, so he goes on. So on a seventh mission, he's up there, seven missions, March 24th, 27th, I think, March time frame. They get a mine laying job. So they have to go put mines in Tokyo Harbor to keep the fleet, you know, at bay. So they're going up there at that night, and they're not as high as they usually are. They're kind of, I think he said 15,000, somewhere in that realm. And they're going in for this mine laying job, and he said the next thing you saw was it's a game where the spotlights, once the spotlights lock onto you, you're done.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's because the spotlights are searching, and once they see, right, find that plane, then it's just... But direction. I mean, all the guns train on that.
And they're at 30,000 feet?
No, they're about 15,000 feet.
Okay. Right.
For the mine laying job.
Oh, okay.
They're laying mines in Tokyo. So his plane gets locked up with spotlights, and he says, next, before I can even do anything as the flight engineer, all four engines are on fire. And he took, the flak came through his station, hit him in the back of the legs and the buttocks. And so he's, where his position is, he's kind of by the, he's, you know, where the co-pilot pilot up in the glass nose, he's, yes, below that.
Right.
Where the nose landing gear is.
Right.
And so he's trying to keep the plane in the air, kind of steering it, and he can actually steer from there. Actually, I didn't know that. So he's trying to keep the plane in the air, and next thing he's not hearing anything over the radio. Next thing he sees is the co-pilot come by and, you know, grab him and say, "Fisk, bail out." And that's when he told him that, you know, there were the only two guys left. The hit killed everybody in the back, because they went back to, and the doors, they opened the door, someone opened the door to the bomb bay, and that flame came through where the flak had started some bottles on fire, some oxygen bottles, and the flame ripped through the entire plane, killing everybody. And so Fisk, the co-pilot goes back to, I think, look for somebody. He's bailing out. So Fisk opens his hatch where the nose gear is at, and he can't jump because the nose gear's in the stowed position. So he's looking manual. He's looking for the manual override. And tries it, doesn't work. Plane's now engulfed in some big, I mean, it's like burning, the whole thing. And just then, the nose gear drops out of the way. And he says, divine intervention number one.
Right.
Yeah, this is divine intervention number one, and counting. So he goes out into the clear blue sky, lands in the field, farmers, Japanese. He's in Japan. I mean, he's in mainland Japan. Farmers are beating the hell out of him because they're angry at him. I mean, they're killing their own people, right?
Right.
So a Japanese police officer actually saves him from those pitchforks and rakes and, you know, whatever.
Right.
So saved by beaten to death, number two. Lives. He finds out later that all eight crew members died in the plane. He and the co-pilot were the only ones out. So he goes on this whole thing, and then he ends up in, because, now I didn't know this either, and I looked this up, and I can't believe I missed this, because I was a really big history buff.
Right.
B-29 pilots were not considered POWs. Did you know that? B-29 pilots were housed separately from B-24 and other bomber pilots and fighter pilots and ground guys.
By the Japanese.
By the Japanese, by the Kempe Tai, right? So the Kempe Tai were the special, like the secret police of the Japanese.
Because of the firebombing stuff?
Because of the firebombing stuff.
They considered them criminals?
That all of them would be executed immediately upon capture.
Whoa.
Because they were special. They were not given the same Geneva Conventions because they were war criminals by the Japanese eyes. So thus they were turned over to the Kempeitai. And so the third night he's a POW. They take him out, blindfold him, put him on his knees and at a stake with a wall. He lines up. He can see through the crack. He sees 10, 12 rifles pointed at him.
Right.
They go through the drill. Raise a sword. Right. And click, 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 all the guns, fire on an empty cylinder. And they all think it's a joke, and they take him back inside. And they do this repeatedly as they're beating them and starving them. So then they get the command that upon if Tokyo is bombed one more time, the Kempeitai commander gave the order to execute all B-29 prisoners. So it got bombed again. And they brought them outside, and they're just doing this over machine gun. They put them out in front of a machine gun with a pit behind them.
Right.
And the machine gun's, going down the row looking at them, and same thing, pulls it, and they all think it's a big joke. Ha ha ha.
So funny.
And they pick him up.
Right.
And so they're going through this whole thing. He actually meets Zamperini. And they talk about that meeting together. And so Zamperini's separated by comm wire or Constantino wire because Zamperini's a prisoner of war, whereas Fisk is a special prisoner.
A war criminal. What I'm going to explain to everybody who Zamperini is.
He was also, I think he was a B-17 guy or B-24 guy. Different.
No. He's a,
Yeah. He was on a plane. They were out there doing like, search and rescue missions.
Oh, okay. All right.
And they got shot down and he ended up at sea and he held the longest sole survivor, survival at sea.
At sea.
Something like, almost 2 months, right? I think it was.
Something like that. And the movie's called
Unbroken. And so then he wrote a book just before he died. And, he's a Pan Am's Olympic sprinter, the whole thing.
Yeah, he's a runner. And
he survived, being a prisoner of war in Japan. So Fisk Hanley, same thing. But he goes through this, and, he's the one that, one of these guys that's got so much energy, and, I could just sit there and listen to him forever. And, he's like, then we, at one point he goes, "What service are you in, Mike?" And I said, "I was a Marine, sir." And he like, big old smile on his hand, he grips my hand really tight. He's like, "Semper Fi, devil dog." And I said, "Thank you, sir." And he goes, "Mike, I'm an honorary Marine myself." And I said, "You are?" And he goes, "Yeah." And, I forget the general's name. And spits it out, real guy,
right.
And says, "During those bombing missions on Iwo Jima where we were practicing, after the war, I was talking to this Marine general, because Curtis LeMay and Fisk got to be good buddies."
Wow.
So he's meeting all these people. And so he goes, "Yeah, I was bombing it. And every time we missed the interior," he goes, "I'm sorry, general, I never got any of those Japs for you, but my bombs always landed right on the beach." And he goes, "You did?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Let me tell you something there, Fisk." He goes, "Just underneath that 8 inches of that sand is coral." And he goes, "You know what your bombs did? They made us fighting holes so we could fight the Japs when we landed. And when we dug down, we saw these bomb craters, and we were thanking God for the damn Air Force, So they made him an honorary Marine." I mean, he's just like, wear that title proud. And he goes, "And the other reason why I hold Marines so dear to me," he goes, "the one image I'll never forget is we knew that we'd been, or the war was over with. And it was like August 25th. So it's close to getting to be the end of the war." It's in his book he gave me. And so he gets ready and they're all out front and it's Marines. It's a Marine TBF or, a torpedo bomber.
Right.
And it says Marines on it. And it comes over and drops, opens its torpedo bay and drops these crates perfectly. And they're all mounds, almond joys. and drops it, and it lands right in the middle of the cesspool, like where they're, you know, they dump all their stuff.
Right.
And he goes, those damn Marines, I swear to God, they did that on purpose. You know, just for so I could laugh about it later on. Then he goes, but then they made it up 2 days later when we looked out in Tokyo Harbor, we see the fleet, the Navy fleet sitting out there in the harbor. He goes, I mean, Mike, let me tell you something. That look, when I can see out there, and you can see the stars and stripes on every ship out there. And then all of a sudden, here comes four Amtraks cutting through the water, flying the Marine Corps colors and the national flag. And they come up on the shore, and it says Marines on the side, and here comes these big, tough guys outside. And they're helping us up, picking us up, and bringing us back. You know, and it's like, just, man, you know, he's just like, oh, I love you guys.
You know, that day, I want to say the flyover was, like, every plane that could get in the sky was like 2,000 planes in a flyover. It's something crazy. I can't remember the number. But you see it, and it makes you laugh. And MacArthur wanted to show a force when they got to Tokyo Bay, so the Japanese people would know that this is no joke. There will be no turning back. You are now conquered. And so he was just outside of Tokyo, Mike?
Yeah, he was just outside of Tokyo. He was in Tokyo. He was actually it's in his book, and I'll read it.
Yeah, what's the name of the book?
Camp Omori. Omori is the camp that he was in at the end. Was located on a small man-made island in Tokyo Bay. Okay. The island's major access ran north and south. It was a Japanese prisoner camp with wooden buildings surrounded by a tall. It's Camp Omori. That was his final camp. The book is called Accused American War Criminal, Fisk Hanley, the second. One of the few survivors. And so if you look at history, how many B-29 pilots survived internment by the Japanese? It's a very small number. They killed them all, the ones they got their hands on.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so when you look at the thing goes, too, and it really kind of makes me sad, is the fact there's some videos I'm on Texas Tech alumni. We're going to get him on the show, too.
You know it's bullshit? The Japanese executing anybody for what they would call a war crime. The Chinese would have executed every Japanese soldier that set foot in China, and so would the Filipinos, if that were the case. Right. You're in the Army? Next. What branch of service? Oh, Army?
Yeah.
What they did in Nanking, what they did in Manila. Anyway. But anyway, I digress.
So he comes home in 1945, 46, right? Begins to write all of this down because he realizes, he talks about, I didn't know what PTSD was back then, but I knew I was suffering from something. So what I had to do was write it all down. And he goes, I ended up writing, and he's holding up, maybe 4 or 5 inches of papers. I put them in a file. In 1946, I put them in a file. I wrote everything down. Everything that happened over there. And I put it into a file. And he goes, in 1997, I was approached to write a book, and I pulled that file out and gave it to somebody. Sat there for that long, 50-something years.
That's how they did it, though, right? Yeah. I mean, and I'll tell you what, and he was probably ahead of the curve in terms of at least he wrote his down, right? Most guys just endured it, whatever they were thinking and whatnot, and didn't talk about it.
But he wants to come on talk on the – he was really happy that we were doing this. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'd love to talk on that. Let's get that going and – take care of that. But he's a super active guy. He's always out talking to people. There are a YouTube channel. There's a YouTube thing on a bunch of his speeches.
On him?
Yeah.
All right. And spell his name for us.
It's with an E. So it's Fiske Hanley. Hanley. The second.
The second.
Oh. Huh.
No wonder he became a pilot. Yeah, that's a pretty refined name. Anytime you got a number next to your name, you're either rich or really smart. Rich or really smart.
Yeah, or neither.
So tell us about, so you're the MC of this event. Where you meet Fisk. And you meet other people. Well attended, good?
Oh, sold out. Yeah, sold out way in advance. It's always sold out.
It's awesome.
Yeah, they're constantly all. It's a bunch of just good people, veterans, coming together and people that support veterans, and holding a dinner in their honor. And great presentations. Chuck talked a little bit about his program where they do the Labradors, and then we did Fisk. Now, like I said, Fisk is something else, though, man. He is. He's one of those guys that leaves an impression on you.
Oh, no, you know what? At the marathon, I met Woody Williams, right? And when I was interviewing him, we talked about why he joined the Marine Corps and all this other stuff. But he has a foundation, and his foundation is devoted to honoring Gold Star families. And it partners with people all over the communities, all over the country, to build memorials to Gold Star families. And he said, do you know, Mike, until I started this, there was no memorial in the country to Gold Star families? Like, there's highways named after them, but there's never been a memorial. I said, okay, look, you have to promise me you'll come on my show and talk about Iwo Jima later, because I want to talk about your foundation. Mike, he was so excited, and like, so his life work, like, he's not done. Mm-hmm. You know, he was so excited. He said, you know, now we have monuments in 44 different communities, and we've got another 23 that are getting ready to put them up. I was like, wow. You know, they're just great in terms of examples for your life.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys have given so much to so many people, and they're just wonderful to be around, and you get this strength from them. I mean, because you know what I feel like? I feel like when I was a little kid and would go to parades and would see, you know, guys who fought in the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, I'd see those guys, and they were bigger than life, and they still are. You know, and you had a chance to spend time with one, and just cooler than cool. You know, so that was what, Friday night? Saturday night? What night did you do that?
Saturday night.
All right.
So, yeah, and, you know, so, like I said, he was so funny. He's like, Mike, you know how many B-29s are still flying? I said, yes, sir, two. He's like, what? How do you know that? I said, I'm an industry guy, too. And before he said that, I said, Doc and Fifi. And he's like, I like you. So we were talking about B-29s. I mean, we talked about everything, man. I mean, he was just one of those guys, you know. B-29 was the first plane like that was pressurized, you know, that different pressurized sections within the B-29. It was just amazing technology at the time.
And where does he live, Mike?
He lives here in Fort Worth, downtown.
In Fort Worth.
He's always on the go.
Born and raised in Texas?
Born and raised Texas, Texas Tech alum.
Oh, wow. Well,
yeah, good for him. Up there in the panhandle of Texas.
Did you ask him? What do you attribute to living to 99 to? Did you ask him?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about it. He says he doesn't know yet. He believes that, you know, there's some, he has a story to tell and some people, something to give, so.
So that's what
that's why he's still here. You're not done yet.
Woody Williams says a jigger of vinegar with two teaspoons of honey. He said, I drink it every day. I said, you're not
vinegar. I would just do a shot of bourbon every day. Same damn thing.
He said, no, all my family doesn't. I said, all right. And the commandant was standing there, and he said at the same time.
That's pretty cool.
I'll start it tomorrow. And he laughed. He laughed. But they're awesome guys. What else? What'd you do the rest?
Hey, switching channels. I saw Bohemian Rhapsody this weekend.
Are you a Queen guy?
Oh yeah.
Really? That was a bit. Back in the day, he was a bit of a freak show.
Yeah, but he was still. He was one of those guys that was, you know, taking music to a whole new era, and pretty incredible singer. You gotta say that, what he did with the music.
Oh no, you know, first of all, just his look, right? He had this crazy exotic kind of look.
He was Pakistan. I didn't know that. He was Pakistan.
What?
Yeah, Farouk.
Come on, come on.
Look it up. Freddie Mercury's real name. Look it up. Look right now. And then say it to everybody. You're going to go, what? Look it up. This way I can't make it up. Farouk Balsara.
Farouk Balsara. Known professionally as Freddie Mercury, was a British singer-songwriter and record producer, best known lead vocalist. I want to know his lineage.
From Zanzibar, you know, that whole...
He was born of Parsi descent on Zanzibar and grew up there and in India before moving with his family to Middlesex, England in his late teens. Wow.
And, you know, that was the time in England where they didn't really like them people there. It was just a really hard time. So he changed his name to Freddie first and then went to Mercury.
Bohemian Rhapsody. I was never the biggest Queen guy. But I didn't dislike it. But he was quite, when you would see him, you know, and the whole gay thing, right?
Yeah.
You looked at him, and I don't know. We didn't talk about it that much. You looked at him like, well, he's a bit different. I mean, just an incredible singer and performer,
You know, coming out of, you could look at the Beatles in the early 70s and say the same thing. Man, they're gay because the way they're dressed. They're very flamboyant back then.
Right. Well, you know, we saw the Beatles more from suit and tie, right?
Yeah.
Right. Then they went to, you know, different clothing, then the Nehru jackets, and then the Sgt. Pepper stuff where they've already gone to India and they come back and you're like...
Yeah, with the gurus.
What happened? Freddie Mercury.
You know, Freddie started out the same way. Freddie got married. He was married to Hunt. What's her name? Linda Hunt.
Oh, really?
And then he grew... I mean... You know, it was like the movie did it really good. I mean, where it showed him, you know, he's fighting. He doesn't know what is, you know, why he's acting out this way. And then he realizes, you know what, but he's, you know, he's in that time when people didn't want to talk about it. And which I didn't know is that, and I remember seeing that video much later, but the one that they're all, dressed in drag, they're, you know, and they're cleaning the house. There's a MTV. MTV first said no to that because they didn't want to promote drag queens. Look at them now. Boy, have we come a long way, boys.
A little bit. Boys and girls. You know, what's interesting is that, you know, so I'm reading about him now, right? So his dad works for the British. And then they moved to Zanzibar so that he can continue his job as a cashier at the British Colonial Office, right? He's a professional cashier. You could see this guy, right? Immaculately dressed, right? With the green visor on, right? And this is his uniform to go to work as a cashier for the British. And he goes to Zanzibar to do that and then ultimately, is allowed to immigrate to England. It's just a different, when you go to Singapore, What's the hotel, Mike? The Raffles Hotel in Singapore, where they made a Singapore...
Raffles Hotel.
Yeah, the Singapore... Yeah. I mean, the Brits had this kind of regal way when they would go places. And you can see, like... and then
they were built on class.
Yeah, to get a job, right, was to get stable and be respectable. And you might have been a doorman, right? But you see in movies these guys, you know, immaculately dressed. He's going to be the doorman, and that's what he does. And they worked their ass off at those jobs. And what they did was they changed the trajectory of their family's life, you know, by being employed by the Brits. So it's really interesting to watch that stuff. And in this case, you know, his son, you know, without that job, without being a cashier for the Brits, his son never gets to the United Kingdom and never becomes what he becomes. So
and Queen never sings. Yeah,
it's Queen never sings. What what did so rate the movie? Did you like the movie?
I would say, well, if you read the critics lambasted it.
Oh really?
But the viewers completely turned that around. I mean, so I would put it up there. If you're a music fan. It's really good. It's interesting to see how he thought. I mean, and they did a pretty good job of, from what I understand, reading about some of the stuff where people were like, yeah, he nailed it. And it, Rami, I think is, what's his name? Rami Malek plays Freddie Mercury? Malek? Yeah, Rami Malek. So Rami, if you ever watched, the whatchamacallit, what was the series called? Pacific.
Huh?
So Rami, who played Freddie Mercury, was a Marine in Pacific. He was actually one of the head guys.
No kidding.
And he played, I'm looking him up right now, so man, early work. He ain't even on here. It's gotta be earlier than he was the Night at the Smithsonian, he played the Mummy. yeah. But if you look at the cast of the movie Pacific, he actually, what year did that come out?
Man.
Oh, 2010. He played Snafu.
Oh.
Meryl
what?
Shelton. Yep, that's Rami.
Dude,
remember
he's
Snafu?
One of the most
hard-ass guy at first.
Well, he's one of the most memorable guys in the whole thing because he's from New Orleans and he talks like, and he's the one that tells in the book. And I was wondering if they'd put some of the scenes from with the old breed in the book because the book is brutal. I mean, the shit that got done and. Eugene Sledge is about to mutilate a Japanese. He's going to cut teeth out of which Marines did. They stole gold fillings out of teeth. And he's getting ready to do it, and Snafu says,
don't do it, Eugene.
Don't do it,
you're
Eugene.
You're going to regret it.
Yeah. And he just says, it's the character.
And then he says, they battle. He says, well, I've seen you do it. You know, and they go back and forth, and he goes, well, I've already crossed over to the other side, Eugene.
But he has that way of talking.
Yeah.
It's just a really, and it, you know, it isn't, it's emblematic of the diversity that you find in the military. From every corner of the country, every creed, every religion, all of it. And it's just like this incredible learning experience. And he's emblematic of that. Like that.
He's one of the guys.
Yeah.
I've served with guys, Snafus.
Right. No. And you.
Absolutely.
And you see.
And Eugene's.
And you see him in the combat scenes, and he was a hell of a mortarman, right? The way they show them working and what they do together and stuff like that. I think he's probably the most unique character in Pacific.
I think he's a very critical character because he's like the tormentor. Remember, I mean, he's like, come here, or he's like, boot, get away from me, boot.
Right.
And he's hard on guys. He doesn't want to remember, you know, like, Eugene, I wouldn't remember their names. They're going to be dead tomorrow anyway.
Right.
And then the one kid kept telling him, like, you know, and then when Rami the new, there's two boots, and then the guy screws up and takes his poncho and takes the old, the, you know, the new one off the ammo and puts the, put it on his hand, puts the old one on there, and the ammo leaks, and they have a short round, and it kills the guy. And Snafu knows he did it. You know, and just lets him have it with that. It's like, you know, I want you to look at this. You killed this boy. You killed him. You killed him today. You know, and it's not a fact of, he wants, people were like, you watch that movie and you see that scene and you're like, oh, there's, that's just hazing somebody. No, no, no. What Snafu was teaching him, it's not about you. When he took that good poncho from him, gave him the crappy one, it's not about you. He was testing it. It's about us. You know, and I think it's one of those things that if he would have went through the night and sucked it up with that crappy poncho and gotten wet like everybody else had gotten wet, it, you know, it's just a matter of time. But no, he decided that he took the good one back off the ammo, got the increments wet on the mortar rounds, which cost the kid's life because they had a short round. So they have this way of making those things point out, you know, in those movies that are just fascinating. You're like, I get it. Wow.
Well, you know? I mean, if you
know, I didn't have to learn like that, though. I just learned by someone telling me. Like, okay.
Right, but...
But there are a lot of people that have to go through those and learn those life lessons. You know?
Right.
And people... Some, and if you're not... If you're on the outside, people look at it and they don't see it the same optic where they're like, oh, that's hazing. Or look at him. He's belittling them or he's taking advantage of us, right. Position of being a new guy. No, 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 no. What he's trying to do is make him catch up. You know, those guys had months, years of experience because of the combat experience. And now those young guys wanted to stay alive. They needed to catch up. They need to learn fast, and they did it in different ways, and that was one of them.
Yeah, but you, again, Mike, we know you don't have time. You know, I don't have time to sit down here and be nice to you because, you know, and they knew exactly what happened. In the scene, they know exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Right? They yelled some, you know, all of a sudden they're yelling a short round, and Snafu's head snaps, you know, right to the guy. And, you know, it's, yeah. Learn lessons. Rough lessons, man. Rough lessons. His character. And you know, when he gets off the train, so they come back and they land, I think in San Diego or Long Beach or something. And then they have their outfits on and they get on the train and they're, you know, they're asleep and they're waking up, they're talking. And I think Snafu stands up when the train stops.
Yeah.
In New Orleans. And he just gets off. He doesn't even say goodbye. And you're going, no, wake him up. Say goodbye.
Asleep.
Yeah, say goodbye, man. You can't just walk off. But they reunite later because I've seen pictures of him.
They reunite and become lifelong friends until they're dead, you know,
right.
He dies.
Right. I remember him getting off the plane. I was getting off the train. I'm like, no, you got to wake him up. Say goodbye.
No, because we would have done the same thing.
No, I'd have woke you up.
No, hey. You would not.
Hey,
I would have told you if you would have woke me up, I'd have been pissed. I'd like, get away from me.
You have any food?
Snafu's reminding you that it's not about you. It's, you know, it's, there's nothing to be said. You're so close that you don't have to say anything.
I don't know, man. You don't know if you're ever going to see each other again, right?
You will.
Well, you know that later, but not at the time. But no, it's right, just his way. So he's one of the most compelling characters in the whole, because he's in the whole thing. You know,
yeah.
He's in the whole thing from the time Eugene gets to 3-5 to the end of the thing. Interesting. I don't know, how do we get there from Freddie Mercury?
Because he portrayed Freddie Mercury.
Wow, that's a huge honor. A huge honor.
I'm gonna talk. He wants to come on board. He wants to come and talk, you know, and do this kind of stuff. And you remember who we were talking about?
When?
Ronald Spears.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. one of the guys lived out here from that group. I'm gonna track this down. Someone told me.
Is he still alive?
Yeah. I gotta find out which one it was. But it was one of Ronald Spears' guys.
Oh.
And he could said, because we were talking about Spears, Ron Spears, and someone said to me, hey, you know, and he said the name. He said the name, and he said,
he lives out here.
He lives right down here. He goes, Mike, here's his phone number. Give him a call.
What?
And he served with Spears. And I'm like, are we talking about the same one? He goes, yeah, the guy from Band of Brothers. I'm like, yep, got it. Got all right.
That's crazy. That is crazy. The,
I'll find out which one it is.
Louis Zamperini. Yeah, that whole, I never saw. Did you see that movie?
Yeah, I saw Unbroken. That was really, that's a tough movie to watch.
I never watched it. I did see the article about, Zamperini and, Angelina Jolie, who produced the movie.
Maybe, which surprised me. Yeah,
yeah, which I'm like, what? And she talked about his story and how much she was moved by his story,
right.
and why it ultimately took the fashion that he did. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then there was something else about it. He was a runner in Griffin Torrance. And was a punk.
His whole story about even before he got into the military. I mean, he had a learning disability. They classified him as back then. I mean, a little bit now it's like a attention deficit disorder. You know, and he talks about it. You know,
yeah. And then was it
for going to his grandmother or his grandfather's house and learning to run to exert all that energy? You would have never been anything.
Yeah, and then he winds up going. He winds up going to USC, I think, on a track scholarship, and then he's in the 1936 Olympics. Yeah.
Well, he breaks every track record, collegiate track record, when he first starts running. People were like, "Who the hell is this guy?" Yeah, and then he goes to the Pan Am Games, and then he goes in the 1936 Olympics and meets Hitler. But blows it out of his ass. Because he doesn't take it seriously.
Right.
He's a young kid still, you know?
Right.
He didn't have that discipline.
Yeah, he's stealing stuff on the trip over on the boat. He's stealing stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, he's a bit of a mess. And then he comes home, and, you know, isn't it, religion plays a big role in his life. He came home, and he was drinking, and, you know, he was living it, you know, he was acting it out. And
then I think his grandmother, grandfather got involved again and got his life straightened up.
Yeah, I want to say they took him to see, like, Billy Graham or somebody in Los Angeles, and it changed his life forever. And, he's a revered guy in the USC community. He stayed active in it and whatnot. So, wow. You got a chance to meet another one. Fisk Kenley, did he retire out of the Army, or did he come home and get out? What did he do?
He was medically retired.
Medically retired?
They beat him. Dude, if you read... they never took care of his wounds, so he has real bad, you know, he had bad infections in the back of his legs and in his lower back. He had some lower back injuries. I mean, he's at 99. I don't know how. I mean, shit. Dude, I mean, he's one of those guys that puts everything back in your perspective little box of, I don't rape to bitch, you know?
So he was not, he was a flight engineer and then took over flying the aircraft, and that's how he got down to the ground?
What's that?
So he wasn't the pilot of the aircraft, he was the flight engineer?
No, he was the flight engineer.
Okay.
Up front, yeah, underneath, in that bubble.
What did he get out of the Army? Captain?
First lieutenant.
First lieutenant motivator.
Yeah, well, by the time he joins in 1944, goes to flight school, graduates from Texas Tech in Lubbock, goes to flight school, becomes a flight engineer, right? Because they all go first and then they're broken out. Because he had an engineering degree, Lubbock, Texas Tech,
right.
Technical, you know. So they make him into flight engineer, and then now he's flying, learning his job, and then they put him together with a crew before they ship him out, and then they fly their B-29 out to Tinian, and then they practice. So it's the turn of the year, 1945. He goes on his seventh mission, you know, so seven missions don't take 7 days. You can do two missions a day. So he's not even there a month, he says, and he's shut down.
Shit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of his stories of when he's talking about, there's one that he's talking about, they were doing a high altitude bombing mission. And, he said that sight when that B-29 gets hit and just crumbles and falls apart. The problem with the B-29, B-17, B-24, much lower altitude, much easier to get out of once it's hit. B-29 is all compartmentalized, pressurized, flying at a lot faster.
It was pressurized?
Yeah, it was a pressurized plane. So when it took its hit, it was much harder to get out of. And, you know, it fell from a much higher altitude. He says that he's talking about the second time when he's actually in the slipstream. You know, he jumps out of the plane. He's fallen. He reaches over for his ripcord, like he's been taught, because they don't teach you to jump up. They don't ever teach you to, like, practice parachuting. They always said in the Army, and probably now then, you'll figure that out when you're falling.
Right.
So he reaches over, can't find his ripcord. Then it dawns on him, he's wearing his flak vest. So he has to reach underneath his flak vest and then pull the ripcord from in there. You know, because it sat on top of his parachute ripcord, but underneath his parachute. And then, you know, it came under the canopy and landed in the villagers in the middle of the night. Beating the crap out of him. Funny guy. I mean, just a great guy. I mean, you just take on, you know, you see the energy. You're around him and you just start absorbing that energy.
What did he come back and do with his life?
I'm not there in that book yet. We didn't talk about that. We talked about war stories.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So you'll see him again now. He's not that far, yes?
No, he's not that far at all. I'm actually... I think I'm going to talk to him this week and then see him next week. But like I said, we talked about coming on the show. He's like, absolutely. So.
That's awesome. Now, you know, it's one of the coolest parts about, you know, the whole veteran community. You know, you sometimes, like being a little kid again. You know, you get to meet pieces of American history. And if you grew up reading about these guys and, I mean, you do feel like a little kid, you know, mm-hmm. and because these guys are still your heroes, and the stories they tell are phenomenal. You know, I mean, I can't even imagine. Can you imagine being over Tokyo during that firebombing and looking down at it?
Oh, scary as hell.
Yeah, yeah. Like what the hell? No, awesome stuff. All right, man. You have anything exciting? You do anything else exciting over the weekend after you went to see Bohemian Rhapsody?
No. No. I can't remember. We did a bunch of stuff. It's been a long time. Testing a new site. So I'll talk about that tomorrow or Thursday if you want. Talk Gun Talk.
Gun Talk. Let me write it down. What site?
I can't tell you right now.
Why not? Is it classic?
Classic.
I respect that.
But it's a pistol sight that anybody listening, if they have a pistol that would fit this, of course, can actually do this. And so we'll talk about it. You don't have to send it away for machining. You know, machining the top of your slide costs, you know, anywhere from $200 to $500, depending on who does it. And then everything. Then you change, you know, you're gone forever. But this new thing, this new device, is a new breakthrough where even you can actually install it on your current gun and shoot with an optic on your pistol.
Ooh.
And it's pretty damn nice. I'll send you a picture of it.
The
that way I can put it up.
I've got an email, but I don't know if I want to read it to you.
Hey, what's going on with the North Carolina thing? Did it fall through?
No, well, I'll find out now. I mean, it might roll right because it's a you're familiar with the contracting aspect of a not taking something to bid, single source, validating the uniqueness of the single source and therefore the requirement of it. So that whole dance. So they've been gone obviously since last Friday. So I should hear something. Maybe not today, but tomorrow. So as soon as I
good old MCCS.
That's exactly
the Marine Corps mafia. Yep, legalized mafia.
Yeah, but you know what? If it rolls in January or whatever, so be it. But Mike, when I was up in Mankato this last weekend last week.
Yeah. Did you do what I asked you to?
Would you ask me to?
Can you all raise the flag and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I didn't have to. And let me tell you, I thought of it. You want to know why?
Why?
They started it themselves.
What?
Yes.
There's hope.
There's hope. Well, no, it's small town Minnesota.
Did you tell them?
No, I didn't say shit.
I want to tell you something.
I did not say shit. I didn't say shit. I smiled, though. I smiled. Yeah. I took my... my grandfather on my father's side was a combat engineer in World War I. He fought in every major engagement that the American Expeditionary Force, Company D, 1st Engineers, came to the country in 1914, went back to Europe in 1917 as a private, advanced to the rank of corporal, wounded twice. So I took his medals with me, and I had him on the podium as my own little way to honor him. But, Mike, let me just tell you, of the people that showed up to hear me do the post-traumatic winning thing, half of them weren't veterans, but wanted to hear what veterans had to say about trauma. It was cooler than hell, and it was a great 2.5 days. It was awesome. So it only made me want to do it more. Only made me want to fight more because it's so frustrating when you hear everybody has the same experience. You know, get the prescriptions, don't want them. What they want is somebody to talk to who can tell them, okay, hey, look, here's the next step for you. But what they get is somebody who takes notes and says, and at the end of the hour looks at them and says, same time in 2 weeks? Yeah. All right, see you then. That's it. It's bullshit. And so, it's just all. It was very cool, very cool. And having veterans come up to you and just, can I give you a hug? Nah, man, I don't hug. Okay, so how about we shake hands? Nah, man, I want to hug you. Oh, man, all right, I hate this. Funny, and then all the different people you meet from Vietnam veterans to the Korean War veterans to that come up and say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We need it. I wish somebody would have told me that stuff. So it was very cool. Very cool. So, anyway. All right, man. It was fun. But it was cold in Minnesota. Mankato, Minnesota is in south central Minnesota. It was 9 above. I was like, come on, man. This is the banana belt. Not supposed to be this cold. It's supposed to be in the 20s or 30s. So, but it was fun. I had fun. Hey, listen to this. I land in Minneapolis, and I go to rent a car, and I'd lost my driver's license.
What?
Lost my driver's license somehow on the flight. I got on the plane. I had it when I went through security, and then I didn't have it.
Did you call somebody?
No. dude named Sergio, an Italian guy from Italy. Who emigrated here, rented me a car with no driver's license.
I wouldn't have.
I know. Well, the first woman didn't, and I'm ripping my shit apart. I didn't even get pissed. Why would I get pissed at her? But I would get pissed.
Yeah, it's your fault.
I know.
Why
make
it her fault?
Right? So I don't know, because I could. So
the American way.
Exactly. I take my shit over, and I'm away from their kind of kiosk thing, and I'm like, where would this thing be? And now I'm thinking, well, I think I have a picture of it on my phone. Maybe not. And I'm going through, well, I could Uber down there. I could call them. They could come get me, but I won't get there in time, blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden he says, hey, sir? And I said, yeah. And he said, come here, I can help you. And I had a picture of three of my old driver's licenses that I took just for shits and giggles.
Do you know your number?
Yeah, I do. But he said, the woman said, we need at least need a picture of it. And he said, you're a veteran? And I said, I am. And he said,
you said that?
I didn't. She asked me what I was in town to do. I said, well, I'm going to give a talk at Mankato. And she said, about what? I said, about PTSD. And the only ID I had was my retired ID because I didn't have my driver's license. So I pulled that out. And so he saw that. And then when I was looking for my stuff, he said, hey, I'll help you. So, Sergio, man, I'm writing a letter to Hertz saying I'll never rent from another car company the rest of my life.
Well, don't write to them saying thank you because Sergio will probably get fired.
That's what I thought. You know, you didn't follow procedures.
Yeah. You think don't do that, man, because you'll get him fired.
That's what, you know, but no, somehow or other, I've got to do.
You're going to get him fired. Good job, Mac. Sergio from immigrated here is going to lose his job and now can't feed his family because.
Then they get deported.
Yeah, and then get deported. Oh, yeah. Good job, Mac.
Trump will be at his front door with eyes.
I was just trying to help him.
I know.
I'll have
to make a phone call first. I have an anonymous employee that I want to make sure gets recognized, but he may not have followed all the procedures. Is that a good thing to do or a bad thing to do?
What's his name, sir?
That's classified.
That's when you hang up.
His name's Mike Musselman. He works in Dallas-Fort Worth Airport.
Loser. Yeah, here's his phone number.
Listen, but you know what? I always have good things happen to me at the airport in Minneapolis-St. Paul. I don't know why, but
I don't know why either.
Yeah, magical things.
Sucks ass.
I went through security with two knives in a backpack. They saw them. They're looking at them. On my way to a funeral, Patrick and I, all of a sudden, Patrick's like, what's in your backpack? And I'm standing there and went, oh, shit, two knives. Right.
So, hey, shout out real quick to
Hold on. Both the guys that were supervisors of the security, both former Marines. So they're like, we'll take care of this. Don't worry about it. And so they check my knives as they check bags in a little box. And then they say, hey.
What the hell are you doing, man?
Hey, come on, Mac. Hop in the golf cart. And they give me a ride, and they're talking. One of their kids was in Iraq maybe a little bit before. And I just have, it's like, I don't know, it's a good place for me. The Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, it's all good. All good.
Yeah. Okay, so hey, shout out to Granbury Marine Corps, Junior ROTC, are now 6-0 because they handed Stratford, Connecticut Rifle Club their defeat the other day. So they're in the Orion competition. You know, this is like the Masters tournament. So I think they go on now single elimination because they had to It's 8-week season, two more weeks followed by a single elimination tournament for the top 8 teams who compete for the league championship. This is like the highest
level?
Level. Highest level for non-collegiate. I mean, and these now they're fighting against, like, this is the rifle club from Stratford, Connecticut. It's their rifle club, and man, they just got their ass handed to them by Granbury.
Granbury, something in the water, breed shooters.
Dude, I'm telling you. Well, it's Scott Casey and the way he's doing this. You know, lieutenant colonel. Artillery guy, but we won't hold that against him.
Yeah, what does he know about shooting?
Yeah, they know indirect, but that's about it, maybe. But I got to send you a picture of, if I can get this image, the team photograph is freaking awesome, dude. I mean, they are like, it's pretty damn cool.
What's it look like?
Well, here, can you see this?
Hold on, I have to go back to screen.
I'm trying to blow it up. But it won't.
It won't blow up.
Can you see it?
Hold on. Yeah, I can see it. Is that the
superimposed right in the middle is that Eagle Open Anchor.
Ooh.
They got the flags behind them. They're on that staircase going up like a V. But it's all, and look at poor Stratford. Look at their look. Of course you're going to get your ass handed to you by a team that's got a freaking shooting poster like this.
Exactly. Yeah, just phone it in, boys and girls. It ain't going to be close.
Yeah. I mean, they're kicking ass.
That's good. But you just went and spoke with them that time, right?
I talked to them a lot. They have a range inside the high school.
Yeah, I remember you talking about when the first time we talked about the program. You were talking about, this is awesome, man. This is awesome.
Granbury.
There you go. Granbury. The center of America. Who knew? Granbury, Texas.
That's right.
All right, man. Have a good one. I'll talk to you on Thursday. Gun talk.
Gun talk. We'll talk gun talk the whole time on Thursday.
Classified sites. Right.
Classified. This is all classified. You must have a top 11 secret squirrel access.
There you have it. All right, man. Have a good one.
Yep.
There you have it. The one and only Michael Musselman here on a Tuesday. You know, it is, you do sound a bit like a dork, but it's so exciting to meet guys like that. And they're great examples about what this song means, right? The high life. Right, what we owe our friends who didn't come back, and they're an example to us of how to do it. So my thanks. All right, if you're just tuning in, tell you what you're going to get a chance to listen to today. One, a couple of Village Idiot Awards. Yeah, how about that? Number one, Emmanuel Macron for wanting Europe to put their own army together. Okay, they don't even meet their NATO obligation. They don't have large standing militaries or air forces. They say they can't afford it, and he wants them because the United States is such a menace. Right, to have their own military. Uses the occasion of the 100th commemoration, right, to call out the United States and President Trump and do this. What an idiot, honestly. Meritorious, from his citation reads, for idiotic behavior above and beyond the call of duty. During an international event, Emmanuel Macron, soon to be former president of France, is awarded the Village Idiot Award. However, today he shares the Village Idiot Award with the governor of the state of California, Jerry Brown. California's got issues with wildfires. They've got planning and zoning issues. They've got power line issues. And what the governor of the great state of California decided to discuss was global warming. Probably a good move because he really doesn't want to talk about the other shit, especially on his way out the door. And the reason these people, why all of a sudden, California's had fires for years, why all of a sudden are all these people dying? Good question. Somebody should probably answer that. So you hear that. Then, second hour is a bit of a test. You're gonna hear an interview I did last Friday with a married couple. They have the same name, first and last now. Morgan Mahan. A male and female version. And I want you to listen to the interview. I would tell you their experience with VA mental health and military mental health is pretty typical. And that is, the shit doesn't work. And just as Vietnam veterans had to fight to establish vet centers around the country, I think Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are going to have to fight to get the right shit to happen in those vet centers. Because I would tell you, it's clearly not happening. So you hear that, and then you hear the gunner in hour three. So, with all of that said, have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll do a little battle study about the Battle of Little Bighorn tomorrow. On a Tuesday, Almarine Radio. Over and...